Tales from the Rangers locker room. Tale number one, Jeff Merrick.
What's up?
Last night we heard one of the noises that I despise the most in the locker room. And here is that noise.
All right.
It's the sound of everybody getting in position to interview a very popular athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this noise.
Hey, whoa.
That's the noise of television cameras and print reporters battling for position in front of Henrik Lundqvist as he is nearly crushed by a tsunami of pudgy white men as they attempt to hear his words post game 3 of the New York Rangers LA Kings Stanley Cup final series. I've been in that position before. Yeah. It's the single worst. I don't want to besmirch the good name of your colleagues. It's usually the television cameras that are the ones trying to get their shot and then therefore start climbing on the backs of people that manage to get in front of the athlete. But God, oh man, I was over interviewing Girardi and I heard that mm-hmm. noise. And I'm just like, oh, this is not going to go well. And, of course, it didn't go well. The first question of Lundqvist, somebody goes, what happened? And his response
is, know.
Better question.
Better question.
Oh, God, shit.
Well, I mean, really, that I actually kind of, okay, you know what the follow-up should have been?
What?
Okay, what really happened?
Right.
Just make it relentless.
Tales from the Rangers Locker Room, Volume 2. You know, there's a finite amount of space in a professional hockey locker room, or dressing room, if you prefer. And there were a lot of people in there last night after Game 3. Boy, howdy, were there. You had all kinds of people from all sorts of different countries, shoulder to shoulder, looking to interview anybody. At one point, there was a group of about 60 people surrounding the empty stall of Marty Saint-Louis. We'll get to that in a second. And then the Rangers mentioned, by the way, he's not there, so you can all disperse. But there were so many people in that room, Jeff Merrick, that it was a miracle. None of them stepped on the logo on the floor of the room. Now, there's a reason nobody did. It was because the Rangers, in their brilliant foresight, put down a massive carpet over that logo to protect it from the plodding, trotting feet of the media. Now, I understand today... Game 3, aftermath, day after, the logo was uncovered. And I understand that a few of our colleagues, including Down Goes Brown, may have been chastised for having their feet on the shield, the classic original six shield of the New York Rangers. So my question to you, Jeff Merrick, is why is it okay to put a giant carpet over the logo last night but not have the same carpet over the logo when the same flood of reporters are coming in the day after?
We all live with our myths. We all live with our stupidities. Original Six is one of them. To me, the logo on the floor is asinine, is stupid, is ridiculous. It's fine to have that when you're in the dressing room as a team. I can get that. That's your private moment, and that's a ritual you players and coaches want to observe. I get that. But when those doors are open, that becomes an office for the media. That is where they do their work. These are the rules that we all live by. It's in the CBA, as a matter of fact. These are things that are agreed upon. And I think to make them play Twister in order to get them to do their job is downright insulting. You know what? I would have no problem with anyone walking right across the floor and on the logo of whichever team. Tampa, thank you, Dave Andrechuk. Chicago, New York, I don't care. If you're a media member in that room to do business and you walk on the logo, walk across the floor and step on it, I have zero problem with it, and you should not be chastised for it. Not for
Derek
a second.
Step on it. Yeah, I completely agree. And the worst ever is Boston. Boston's the worst. They guard the thing like they're guarding, you know, the Hope Diamond. It's the stupidest thing ever. They actually position interns around it to make sure you don't step on it. But here's the thing.
I've said it before. Listen, I've said it before. If you don't want people to step on it, don't put it on the floor. It's pretty simple. Like if you put a Rangers logo on a urinal cake, you know, guess what's going to happen? People are going to squirt on it. Don't say, oh, we're going to put a logo on this urinal cake, but make sure you pee around it, or else you're being offensive. Sorry, it's not the way it works. Put a Ranger logo up on the wall. Put your Bruins logo up on the wall. Put your Bolts logo up on the wall if you don't want people to walk on it. Because you know what that is? That is a floor. That is where people walk. You don't want it walked on, put it somewhere else.
And that's somewhere else, by the way, during the whole Justin Bieber thing earlier this season, or was it last season? I forget when it was, with the Blackhawks logo. Somebody suggested putting it on the ceiling, and I agree. I mean, put it on the ceiling. It's like the Sistine Chapel. You pray to the logo every time you walk into the room, and there you go. All right. Now, beyond all this malarkey, game three last night, Rangers lose. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Totally dominated by Jonathan Quick, looking at an 0-3 hole. And as I mentioned before, Marty St. Louis did not speak to the media last night. Everybody was waiting around to hear from him because they had heard from him after every other game, and he always had sage advice, and obviously has been a guy who's been through the wars, as they say. Did not meet with the media. So my question now about Marty St. Louis is this. He's played okay in the final, but not great. And I think specifically looking at the Rangers' power play, you could say that there are some things going wrong right now with the offense of the New York Rangers, and they – you know, St. Louis has got to take some responsibility for that. Is he Teflon now because of the mom thing? For example, as someone pointed out on the show last week, this is a guy who demanded a trade from a playoff team in season because he got boo-boo faced over his GM, snubbing him from the Olympic team. Olympic team eventually got on and won a gold medal on. That whole thing was like Men in Black blinky thing erased from everybody's memory when his mom passed away. And then he became this amazing story and this catalyst for the Rangers' turnaround of the Penguins series. And that's fine. I mean, it's exactly what happened. And condolences. I'm not trying to be cold-hearted here. Yeah. But if anybody else in his position had said, I ain't talking to the media after game three, after talking to the media after every other game, it probably would have been a bit more criticism than came down on St. Louis last night. The fans came down on him. There was a lot of people saying...
If he's made himself available after every game, do you not give him a mulligan on one? Like, does he have to make himself available after every single game?
I'm just saying that if it was Rick Nash saying I don't want to talk to the media, if it was Dan Girardi saying I don't want to talk to the media, if it was anybody who was seen as a goat saying that, I think they would have been chastised for it. But I really think that St. Louis is off limits. I think he's off limits personally. The way things are going right now.
You know, you saw the look on his face, you know, even during the anthem. You saw the look on his face after the Jake Muzzin shot went off his skate and in. This guy's dying inside. This guy really is.
He is.
I know.
As anyone would be, having requested a trade from the team he spent his career with for the sole purpose of winning a cup with the Rangers. And knowing, by the way, that the Rangers will cough up a first-round pick for his services, but yet falling short of a cup.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. Is he Teflon right now? Yeah, probably. That's gonna be a tough interview for the NBC and the CBC guys when this thing is all wrapped up.
You think?
That'll be a tough one.
All right, a couple takeaways from last night's game. Listen, I am nothing but if not a creature of ego. When I told you the Kings would win this thing in five, I was wrong. They could win it in four. But I was right about one thing, Merrick. Jonathan Quick would approach the series in two ways. He would say, this is a chance for me to hit the reset button and have everybody forget about my shit-tacular first three rounds. And if I play well in the final, then they're only going to remember that. And does anyone remember any other game except for what he did last night, doing Jean-Claude Van Damme splits in the crease and using his paddle to make miraculous saves and giving the Kings a chance to be one win away from winning the cup? He was amazing last night.
But I keep coming back to the same thing. Yes, Jonathan Quick was amazing last night, but the biggest story of the playoffs for the Los Angeles Kings is this team is scoring goals at an ungodly playoff clip. That, to me, is the big story of the Los Angeles Kings. That should be number one narrative. Like, when we look back on it, it's easy to look at the goaltender, and because it's spectacular. Like, you look at what he's doing with 32 saves last night. Some of them were, 10 bell saves. But the big story still is L.A. is finding the back of the net. And this is a team that was, 27th in goals scored this year in the regular season? That's the big story still.
They are. I agree with you, but I will say that he's making saves that Lundqvist isn't making. If you go back to game one and Carl Hagelin having the game on a stick on a breakaway, there's a save right there. He made some in game two that were of the same ilk. I mean, he's the reason why they're up 3-0 in the series.
What What could he have? What could Lundqvist have stopped last night? The first one goes off Girardi's skate. The second off San Luis' skate, and the third one's a sweet pass back from Ryan McDonough to Mike Richards.
Don't confuse saying he's outplayed Lundqvist with me being one of these people. Like I saw there's some story on Sports Illustrated site today. Time to blame Lundqvist for fla fla. Really?
He doesn't have the powers of
telekinesis to make sure the puck doesn't deflect off his own players. or deflect off of Dustin Brown. I mean, for God's sakes, I will never hold Lundqvist culpable for what's happening to the Rangers right now because he is the reason they're there. I mean, let's be honest. He's the reason they're there.
Yes, and again, like we mentioned on the podcast yesterday, it's a team that can only score off the rush, and it's a team that cannot score on its power play. Like, what are they, 0 for the last 36 at Madison Square Garden? That's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed. Like everything, the power play formation is exactly the same, channeling everything over that one-timer to Marty San Luis is the same. Remember everything going through Marty in the first series? They got away from it. Now they've gone back to it. Their zone entries are exactly the same. Like, everything about the – nothing has changed from the Rangers. Elaine Vigneault hasn't changed a thing.
Thank you. And it goes beyond the power play, too. I mean, it's not as if he has been scrambling lines or making huge changes or making significant things. He's actually done – he did nothing between games 2 and 3. That would indicate any level of panic, any level of let's get this thing going. I mean, he really did buy into the idea that they were one bounce away. I didn't get that idea in those games, did you? I saw an LA Kings team that started off really poorly, and when they came roaring back, the Rangers were like a second-class citizen in those games.
They are playing them close, right? 5-on-5, they are playing them close. The difference is they can't score when they get in the zone and set up. They can't score on the power play. And LA can score whichever way you want it. And, one of Lundqvist's points last night in that room after dressing down that reporter for his question, they're just not getting any, and I know people hate to hear it, puck luck. Cause I'm sorry, 2 deflections off skates and, you know, 1 errant pass that goes right back to Mike Richards' stick. That's luck.
I know.
That's it. That's
I know
luck.
I know it comes down to luck in some cases, but let's be honest here. In the first 2 games of the series, when the score was close or tied, okay, did any of us look at these games and think anything differently, but it's a matter of time before the LA Kings win unless the Rangers get a bounce? Did anyone see these games any other way? Because that's how I saw them. Am I alone?
Yeah, and I never saw the LA Kings in any type of panic mode either. They go down 2 pucks and it's, okay, fine. There's going to be no panic. Nothing's done hastily. We're playing our game. And it's going to work.
Let's talk about the power play and what works and what doesn't. Here's what doesn't work. When one of your point men on the power play has 1 assist in his last 8 playoff games skating to a -4. And that man's name is Brad Richards.
Yeah, but here's the problem. Who else are you going to put back there? Like we talked about at the beginning of the series, one of the problems with the Rangers is there's no production from their back end outside of Ryan McDonough. So who do you put on the point? Like they don't have Michael Delzato anymore. Like they just don't. They don't.
But
if you want a guy for the power play,
they have a Kevin Klein.
Put him on the power play. I dare you to put Kevin Klein on the take Brad Richards off and put Klein on the power play.
I'm joking. I mean, Delzato was a defensive liability, and I think the Rangers are a better team without him. But you're right. I mean, there is no alternative there when your point guys aren't going well.
But look at your power play at home. It's embarrassing. Like I know Michael Delzato has significant shortcomings in his own zone. He is never, he's never going to win the Norris Trophy. But as far as being someone that can help your power play. Yep, and how different a series would this be if they had a defenseman that could help their power play?
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty significant.
Exactly.
Pretty significant.
Yeah, it would. It would indeed. Richards is a joke at this point. Honestly, why is he here if not to score? He's been terrible.
The game is skating him by.
I know. That's the real issue right now. At that level, the game
is skating him by.
So they'll buy him out and he'll go to the Leafs, right? I mean, that's the thing that'll happen, yeah. Right?
Well, pick your Richards. Which one will go to the Leafs, Brad or Mike?
They gets bought out. One last thing on the Kings, because I've been asked this question a lot in the last couple days by various people, and I think it's an interesting one. Are the Kings at all a template for other teams? in your opinion, as far as teams trying to build their organizations into winners?
Yes, in the sense that the majority of your players need to be homegrown and developed in your system and go through your minor league operation and fight for your spot. And you're going to see another one with Lyndon Vay, who can't make this lineup because down the middle you have Kopitar, Carter, Stoll, and Richards. So it is a battle to make it into the lineup. But that's what everybody wants to do. Like, nothing's unique about the LA Kings in that sense, other than they just have some great players. Like, really, like they've drafted great players. They've Dean Lombardi's made the right choices. Do you want Thomas Vanek or do you want Marian Gaborik? Well, guess what? You picked the right one, Dean.
Right?
You did, bud. You really picked the right one.
Now, here's the thing. There's a couple lessons. I agree with you. I think there are lessons to be learned from Dean Lombardi building this team. But I think ultimately, if people are like, well, let's just get big forwards, is the point. It's just like when people say, let's do things the Boston Bruins way, and Vancouver's trying to do that. Washington's made bones about trying to do that. It's not as simple as that. In both cases, you have the Holy Trinity. You have Kopitar, Doughty, and Quick in Los Angeles. You have Bergeron, Chara, and Rask in Boston. And until you replicate that as your base, anything else is just bullshit.
Because those guys those types of guys are available to draft every single year, and you can pick them off 1, 2, 3.
But that's my point. It's like any idea of mimicking what these teams have done is nonsensical unless your base is correct. And it doesn't have to even be three homegrown guys. It could be two of the three. You know, what did Boston do? Or one of the three? Boston acquired two of them.
That's right. Two of the three were acquired through trade. And Patrice Bergeron, who in his entire life had been the perpetual rookie, going to Bantam, to Midget, to the Q, to the A, to the NHL, is 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year. I mean, sometimes you just get lucky on guys. And let's not forget, too, he was a second-round draft pick.
There are two lessons to be learned from the Kings, okay? The first, as you said, is understand your homegrown talent, allow it to nurture, figure out what parts work, what parts work and what parts don't. Patience is the virtue in creating a championship team at times. But the other thing is, you got to know when to pull the trigger. And that's where Dean Lombardi's genius comes in. He had opportunities in the early part of his tenure there, and when the Kings were kind of on the cusp but not really there, and you're in a big market, and maybe you want to win before you're supposed to win. And he didn't pull the trigger. He was very, very conservative in the dealing of his prospects until the time was right. And the time was right when Mike Richards became available and Jeff Carter became available. He traded Jack Johnson. He traded significant pieces to get significant pieces back.
Braden
Shen. The difference was the pieces he got back were established players. They were in their prime. And the players that he sent out turned out to be really good in some cases. You got to give to get. But you upgraded your talent at a time when your team was ready for that. And Lombardi was genius. He was like a jockey holding back the horse from running, you know, sitting in that four spot, stalking pace. And then when he saw his hole open up, and he just, like, gave him the whip. And getting Carter and Richards, yeah, there's an element of luck there because Philly decided they were cancers and jettisoned them. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you got to give to get, and the Kings were bold at the right time. Adding Gaborik was bold. He pushed all the right buttons at the right time, and now we're looking at a team that's going to win two cups in 3 years. And that's
like
all Lombardi.
How'd you like to be a Philadelphia Flyers fan watching this? And it's Carter, and it's Richards, who's played much better the last few games, and it's Justin Williams.
Oh, yeah, right.
Like, if you're a Flyers fan, oh, man. Because everybody in this industry who follows it is quick to change. To your point, Greg, about Dean Lombardi, why are you taking your time? Oh, no, it's not working. Blow everything up. Change it. Well, that's what Philadelphia has done. And where has it got them? They built, you know, the Philadelphia Flyers wanted to build a perennial Stanley Cup team, and they did. They're called the Los Angeles Kings. That's what the Philadelphia Flyers did.
That's a good and you know what? Maybe they take some solace in the fact that at least Ronnie Hextall is building their team now.
Where did Dean Lombardi come from? Like, where's Lombardi stop? Right. That was Philadelphia. Where's Ron Hextall stop? That was Los Angeles. Like, man, if you're a Flyers fan, this one burns.
Although Barry from Deadspin makes the point that as much as the Carter goal with 0.7 left was soul crushing, having Mike Richards score a definitive goal in a Cup playoff game in MSG. Oof, that hurts.
That's a tough
special
one.
That's a kind of hurt.
And it's just one of those. But it was one of those goals too, where you saw the pass across, and when you saw it come back off Ryan McDonough's stick on the tape, like, "Hey, dude, sweet feet. Oops, wrong guy." You just knew this wasn't going to be for the New York Rangers, no matter what they did.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't exactly, and especially with the way the guy across the ice was playing last night. All right, that's the opening part of the show. Glenn Healy, Mr. Popularity from Hockey Night in Canada, will be joining us in a few. The question of the day is about the competition committee. If you've not been paying attention, the competition committee met on Monday. There's a lot of places you can go and find the sort of things they've discussed and the sort of things that they rejected and accepted. What are the things that you, the most newsworthy things, the things you like the most from the competition committee stuff from yesterday? PuckDaddyBlog at yahoo.com, at Wyshynski, at Jeff America, Twitter, hashtag MVSW.
Let us indeed get to the guest. So enough about this silly intro. He is a ringside reporter slash analyst slash you see him on the hot stove roundtable on Hockey Night in Canada. He is Glenn Healy, former Stanley Cup champion himself, ladies and gentlemen. Heels, how are you today, sir? Long time no speak.
A ringside reporter would mean there has to be some credibility to what I'm reporting.
Well, I see who stands beside. I see who stands beside you, and he almost became a general manager, so there must be some credibility there, Mr. Healy.
I just threw up in my mouth. Excuse me. let me get over that. Yeah, man, we're starting in a good way.
Yeah, getting off on the right foot. Hey, good to talk to you again, Glenn. And we were just before we get to the series itself and what's happening with this buzzsaw Los Angeles Kings. We're just teeing up, you know, the question of the day, and involves the competition committee and whether it's, you know, switching ends to get the long change in the overtime, whether it's what they're doing with the trapezoids with the 2 feet, maybe it's the face-off dot and the hash marks. Anything come out of the competition committee that raises Glenn Healy's eyebrow?
Well, I really like the changing ends. You look at historically over time, the number of goals that are scored in the second period versus first and third. I am between the benches. I watch the frenetic changing. I watch guys at times jumping into my box because they have to change. And it just makes total sense that you've not affected the fabric of our game, but just a little tweak is going to create just a little bit more offense. And, you know, even if it doesn't result in more goals, what I want in our game is just if we can get our fans to the edge of their seat, maybe not out of their seat, just to the edge of their seat more times in a game, then it's better for our sport. And so, you know, Damian Ukubiera, who works for the league, is the guy who's the mastermind of this. He's been working on it for years. He was here in 94 with me when I was with the New York Rangers working with the organization. And a standing ovation and kudos to him. I think it's a really good thing.
You know, I can recall, though, that, I mean, the reason they got rid of that is because unscrupulous goaltenders, Glenn, would chew up their creases before that change. Do you think it would be any different now if you went to changing ends for overtime? Would goaltenders all of a sudden start behaving with their crease?
This is a kinder, softer NHL. It's okay to cry now, you know? You can have a weeping moment. No, I don't think it'll be a factor at all. And would I have done that? Absolutely. But I also wouldn't have stood at the red line and talked to 15 guys from the other team. It's different now, and I think, you know, guys are... As a result, let's adapt and change with the times.
Glenn, the other thing that they talked about at the competition committee stuff was about goaltender interference and the idea that they're very timid about having any kind of video review oversight of goalie interference because at the end of the day, it's them making a subjective assessment of a subjective call. Do you think goalie interference can ever be something that we have oversight on with video review?
Well, I think they really wanted to go down that road, but it's hard to read into intent. You know, like, let's look at the one play last night where Rick Nash drove the net. You know, he, you could tell, purposely tried to get out of the way of Jonathan Quick, which I question that. I mean, if you're going to go down that road, run him right over. That being said, you know, intent sometimes is hard to read. And I think the referees would love it. I think the players would love it. But I think the league just doesn't have an appetite for it yet. Will it change down the road? Well, it took 9 years for them to figure out that maybe changing ends in OT might work. So we might have to wait 12 for this one.
Any issue with the trapezoids and the moving 2 feet either side?
Oh, get rid of it. Most goaltenders can't skate. Their equipment's too big. They stink when they get the puck. This will open up offense. Get rid of it. And, you know, again, I'm all about protecting players, and I think if a goalie comes out to play it just to make a simple mistake and it protects the defenseman from getting annihilated, then I'm all for that. But that one, to me, is a non-issue. I think that rule was put in based on three goaltenders in our game, Marty Brodeur being the number one culprit. And, you know, when you had the three, you had 57 that were applauding it. Thank goodness I don't have to leave the net. This is great.
On the subject of the coach's challenge, another kind of non-starter from the committee yesterday, they're going to kick it to the GMs. There's always talk that, hey, we'll do a thing where we allowed the coaches to give up one of their timeouts to have a play looked at. Do you think that that's just going to be abused as a ploy to get more rest for players, or do you think it's something that could actually be a functional part of our game?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a big factor. I honestly don't. I look at it and I think there's some rules that are silly, and this would be right there on the cusp. You know, the game is played whistle to whistle by the players. It's not played with a timeout. It's not played with coaches. It's played with players. And the guys that execute on the ice, and we're watching it with LA now, they're the ones that define the results, not whether you get one extra look and you can throw a flag on the ice. It's not about that.
Glenn, as you mentioned, and we all know because we all watch, you're right in there between the benches, but there doesn't seem to be a hockey hatred between these two teams. But this year, in all the games you've covered, all the series you've covered, which two teams did you have to use your mute button the most for?
Boston, Montreal.
Really?
I had so many Lucic moments. Great series, great series. I'm going to kill you. Great series. There's no question those two teams didn't like each other. And there were two different teams, right? One was a rugged, tough team that liked to play in the trenches, and the other team was a fast team that backed away from every skirmish. And as a result, it leads to that, you know, kind of that boiling point where you just know you can't get to your opponent emotionally. You can't intimidate them, and it drives you crazy. But those two probably would be the highlight of my series. The highlight of my career, a little different, would have been Chicago, Philadelphia. And that was back when there were five players on Philadelphia that were in the cusp of getting divorced.
Yep.
And if I didn't push that mute button through the course of those conversations, there'd be a lot of unhappy women in Canada that would have to have listened to some of the things that were said.
Was it everyone on the Blackhawks who were giving it to the Flyers five, or were there some guys who were like, yeah, you know what, I'm not going to go there with these guys?
Only the trainers and coaches were exempt. So, and the refs, they were all in. Oh, absolutely. Non-discriminatory. We're all in. We're buying in. Some special moments. But, hey, as a player, I did the same. I mean, I was borderline mouthpiece as well.
What's your take on Henrik Lundqvist here in this final? I think, personally, I think he's getting some undue criticism. I think there's a lot of goals he had no chance on due to freaky, fluky things that happened. But,
you know, I'm not buying the undue criticism, guys. Honestly, I look at a game like last night, and you can argue that he hasn't cost his team the series, or he hasn't cost his team a game. But when you give up three goals on 13 shots, and the guy 200 feet away is lights out, you at some point you've got to not be Eddie Jackman. You got to be Mike Richter, and you got to finish the deal. And I mean, I started the broadcast last night with, you know, you never want to live your life woulda, shoulda, coulda. And that's what the Rangers are going to live their life through this series. We woulda, shoulda, coulda won games one, two, and we shoulda won game three, if not for Jonathan Quick. And that's a tough way to live your life. When an opponent beats you, okay, check to you, hands off, I'll shake your hand. Good series, good series, good series. I'm going to kill you. Good series, all the way down the handshake line. But when you beat yourself like the Rangers have, it's a tough one to swallow.
You know, we were talking about the Rangers the last couple of days. Well, the last, you know, however since long the playoffs have been going on, going back to middle of April. And the one thing that continues to jump out is this seems to me, Glenn, to be a team that only scores off the rush. And when they get the zone, they don't know what to do. And that's even more magnified on the power play. Yet I haven't really seen Alain Vigneault do anything about it. You're closer to the action. Has he done anything about it?
Oh, internally there's debate. And I know that there's people in the organization that are screaming for change, and I am too. I think Brad Richards is absolutely shutting down the New York Rangers power play. So maybe he gets the Conn Smythe if the LA Kings win. But it is time for a change. They did a little wrinkle last night. They put Rick Nash on the point. I just don't know if Richards is fast enough. I know he doesn't have a hard enough shot from the point. We had at one point last night, we showed a Kopitar pass to Martinez, which led to a good chance. The pass was 100 kilometers an hour, the pass. We showed a Brad Richards shot, which was 100 kilometers an hour. So if you can pass the puck as hard as you can shoot it, probably from 50 feet, you're not beating Jonathan Quick. But that has to change, and we talked about it in the pregame show. The power play doesn't change, they don't win. It didn't change, they don't win. And they have to regroup really quickly to get this thing in order.
What who's your Conn Smythe winner if the Kings close this thing out?
Well, there's, you know, a variety of guys. You look at Kopitar and what he's done. I mean, you think about the players he's had to play against. You know, he's had to play against Getzlaff. He's had to play against Joe Thornton. He's had to play against Jonathan Toews. Now, those are really easy guys to play against, aren't they? And so,
yeah,
you know, here he is. Yeah, and lighten it up. He's had a wonderful year. You know, it's hard not to take a look at that Olympic experience and kind of dice that in, too, to make you feel really good. Jonathan Quick, if he plays like he did in Game 3, has he not single-handedly won this series? For that team, even though his goals against isn't good. You know, you look at Carter. Has Carter not been a guy who you say, wow, I thought he was done 3 years ago, and they rescued him from a, you know, kind of a dung heap in Columbus, and, you know, his time in Philadelphia. So there's a number of guys. Even Drew Doughty, you can't not discount the minutes he plays against. Well, again, all the best players he's played against. So
I'll tell you right now, Glenn.
3-0.
I'll tell you right now, Glenn, Doughty seems to be the choice that most of the media is making based on minutes played, based on what he did before the final. If I had a vote, I don't know how I don't cast it for Justin Williams. Like, Justin Williams to me has been the story of the LA Kings offense. Justin Williams has 4 goals, 6 assists, 10 points in games 6 and 7s throughout the playoffs. I don't know how you don't give him MVP on this team, but that's just me.
Well, there you go. Now you've added another one to the mix. So are you not talking now about a complete team, about a four-line team, about a team that just has done something that no other team in the NHL has done, just win 3 Game 7s on the road, do it to unmarkable odds, go down the first week of the playoffs. They were history. They were done. And here they are now, one win away from hosting the biggest and best trophy in all of sport.
Glenn,
were you on Conn Smythe, Merrick? Were you on Conn Smythe?
Right now I'm on Kopitar. Kopitar,
right.
Yeah. And for a lot of the reasons that he'll just laid out too, but the way this guy has changed his game, this year really has been the coming out party for Kopitar. And Glenn mentioned the Olympics, and after the Selke Trophy nod in there as well, getting that sort of notice from people around the NHL, that to me was. His season this year has been all world. Glenn, curious from a player's point of view. Okay, give us a player's perspective on this. You're a New York Ranger. You're down 3-0. Slim and none are the odds, and Slim just left town. For game 4, what's your mentality? How much of you is saying, you know what, even if we win this thing, do I really want to get on a plane and fly across the country just to take another spoonful of medicine and then have to fly back, as opposed to, you know, just saying, this is inevitable, let's just get it over with on Wednesday?
Wow, if there's anyone on the New York Rangers that thinks the way you just put that, we have to erase the 2-day waiting period for handguns. No, they are not thinking that way. You know, it was 7,302 days ago that the New York Rangers won the Stanley Cup in New York. It took 20 years to get back, 2 decades, countless number of players, countless numbers of terrible signings by Glenn Sather to get back to this point. Mm-hmm. You know, the LA Kings, yeah, hey, they were down 3-0. They did it. Why can't we do it? We should be up 3-0. These are all the storylines that you know, I'm going to, if I'm in that locker room as a player, I'm preaching, you know, don't let this moment slip away. Let's do it for Marty St. Louis. Let's do it for Richards. Let's, you know, they did it 10 years ago. All of that put together, you're probably right. There are a few of them thinking, okay, should we just stay in California and start our vacation if we win tomorrow night, or should we just move on? But it's going to be a near impossible task. You know, you think about that trophy, and you're one win away, and you're a good LA King team, one of the best in the league, and all you know, you have to play one game. That's it. And it's yours, and your name goes on it forever. And it's not your, it's your family name that goes on it. It's your last name. It's your mom and your dad that drove you to games, your sister that sacrificed. That's what's most important. And it's the hardest to win game four, but certainly it's the most prized. And, you know, I think, you know, the game tomorrow night will be the best of our series.
Well said, sir. One more for me. Could you pull back the curtain for those of us who watch the television and see you and Pierre crammed into a little box between the benches? How much coordination has to go on between you two insofar as who's on camera when, who takes a step back, who's going to the bench when? Is there a lot of that, or are you now just symphonic in the way you work together?
You cut out for a second, so if I could be kind to ask you to repeat it, that would be perfect. I'm on my cell
phone. Oh, yeah. No, no problem, man. I just wanted to know how much coordination goes on between you and Pierre between the benches, as far as who's on the air when, who has to take a step back, you know, that kind of stuff. Is it constant communication between you two, or do you both kind of know who's doing what when?
No, it's a 2-month constant ignore. So if that's a good answer for you. This is what they call, you know, that one of my most favorite thing is For the Love of the Game, the baseball movie with Kevin Costner. So basically when I'm between the benches with Pierre, it's cue the mechanism. Shut it all out.
Just go into robot. You're the only thing that exists. It's a solipsistic Glenn Healy. Healy's, you're the best. I look forward to seeing you around the rink. We'll talk again real soon. Thanks. Enjoy game four.
All right, gentlemen. Have a great one.
There he is, Glenn Healy from Hockey Night in Canada.
It's a
pretty
Healy.
Candid answer.
Yeah. Wow. So maybe it's a little bit of a miracle that there hasn't been an incident.
Nah, they're both professional.
But dude, seriously, I look between the benches last night, and they are literally shoulder to shoulder, all four of their paws up on the boards, watching the play go by. It's very close quarters down there. It's very close quarters down there.
Yeah, they really though tend to do their. I mean, if you watch, like, if you're at a game, if you're at a game that both CBC and NBC are doing, you can really see how they really do. Glenn's point is the right one. They really do ignore each other and just focus on what they have to do. There's no sort of deferring. Hey, this is my shot. You're in my shot. Hey, can you not talk here? You know, not jump in on your play-by-play guy. There's none of that. Everyone just does their job. Mm-hmm. And his answer is the right one. They really do just ignore each other. Probably for the
best.
I don't
know about you, but when it comes to Conn Smythe, I'm kind of a big moments guy. Like, I understand the argument for Doughty is that he's been good the whole way through. Mm-hmm. Like, I get that. And I know
except,
the ice time,
for,
you can't deny that. He's been great.
Yep.
But, like, you look at what Williams has done, Carter. See, for me, Williams and Carter are more attractive candidates than Kopitar and Doughty. They've both been good wire to wire. There's no question about that. But you think about MVP Conn Smythe moments. You think about what Carter's been able to do with his that hat trick. You think about the goal last night. You think about Williams in games 6 and 7. I'm much more – maybe it's just the way my brain is wired with this voting stuff. But, like, I am much more of a big moment, memorable run, Claude Lemieux scoring game-winning goal, that kind of shit for the Conn Smythe than I am about anything else.
Yeah, I'm kind of more of the model of consistency, that game in, game out, you draw top assignment and you excel. It may not be the Game 7 overtime winner, you know, triple or double overtime style, but every single game, when the coach taps your shoulder, he knows exactly what he's going to get out of you, and it's at a high level. In all
so
three zones.
You wouldn't have given Kane, you wouldn't have given Kane the MVP last year.
That's a different one for me because
Crawford,
well
maybe?
Actually well I, it, to me boy, that's a tough one. I probably at the end of it would have given it to Pat Kane. I think even though there were stretches where he was invisible, But last year seemed like more of, because was there really anyone who was that, you know, that model of consistency last year for the Blackhawks? Normally it's Jonathan Toews, but he had a brain vacation to the point that Brent Seabrook had to calm him down in the penalty box. I probably would have given it to Pat Kane last year.
Right.
Yeah, but I was the guy that in 2010 would have given it to Duncan Keith over Jonathan Toews.
But you can't. Well, you can't because of politics. That's why Daddy's going to win it. It's politics.
Doughty or Kopitar? I think there's some real movement for Kopitar in all this.
I think that most people are going to say Doughty. I would be fine with Kopitar. I would give it to Williams.
If you're a writer, which story? You're a writer. Okay, Greg, we know this. You write. You're a writer. You have to choose on your ballot who wins the Conn Smythe Trophy. Now, we all know that writers cheer for the best story. Which story would you rather write? The Drew Doughty story or the Anze Kopitar story? What's more interesting to you?
If Kopitar. I'm Michael Farber, just say the Anze Kopitar story.
No,
if I'm Michael Farber, the Kopitar story. If I'm everyone else, it's the king making of Drew Doughty.
Yeah.
Because they've all written it throughout the entire run.
I would think you guys would defer to Kopitar. Doughty's
more
Doughty is a better talker, and he's more entertaining, and he's funny, and he's like the slacker who just happens to be one of the best defensemen in the world. Like, okay, I'm going to the gym. I'm going to the couch. What are you doing today, Drew? I got some ironing to do. I got to iron the couch with my ass. Like, that's Drew Doughty.
But I also think the heart of this team, even though I agree with you, the offense is the more important component in this playoff run, the heart of the team is still defense. And I think when Quick has been bad throughout the postseason, you could look at Doughty as being the guy who held the fort defensively. And I think that plays into it, too.
I don't know.
Yep. I don't think it's a wrong answer, but, you know, 9 points in his last five playoff games. Another plank in my platform, by the way, is the idea that this whole notion of you count the last round as much as the first round is asinine. Okay, if that were the case, then you should be able to give the Conn Smythe to someone who crapped out in Game 7 of the conference final if we're not going to weigh the last round more than the first round. True or false? Right?
Yeah, no, I know.
Justin Williams has 9 points in his last five playoff games, and three of the five put them in line to win the cup.
I would have zero problem with Justin Williams getting the Conn Smythe Trophy. Zero problems. And you want to talk about a great talker? Justin Williams is a fantastic talker and a fantastic
interviewer. He's a fantastic talker. That's just the idea that if you scored 20 points in the first round and then had five the rest of the way, you could win the Conn Smythe. Round.
Was it the one year that Doug Gilmore for St. Louis, they bowed out in the semifinals. He still ended up winning the playoff scoring race. What year was that? It was like 86 or something like that. 80, I can't remember.
Whatever. And there was the year that Gavrik went nuts and Jaguar ended up winning the Conn Smythe in the final, even though I think Gavrik might have led the league in scoring that year too in the playoffs. Whatever. It wasn't a devil, I know that, because there was nobody they could point to and say, oh, hey, this guy should be the MVP. Hey, listen, it's a great problem to have when you have 17 different candidates for one award. I'm just saying that, you know. The obvious winner is Justin Williams. Well, let's just not kid ourselves.
I'd have no problem with it. I know he is Mr. Game 7. He's LA's Mark Messier.
Game 7. How many other guys in this team are called Mr. Game 7? I'll tell you, none. There's only one.
Yeah, I know.
Only one Mr. Game 7.
I know. You're Mr. Monday Night. You're like Rob Van Dam. I know. I get it.
That's exactly right. Mr. Rob Van Dam. Mr. Game 7. Game-winning goals in these playoffs. Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, Jussi Jokinen, Justin Williams. He's the next on the list. Oh, granted, he has two. He has two, just like Dustin Brown and Tyler Toffoli. But he still has two. Overtime goals. Justin Williams has one. The only other player on the Kings that matches that total are Marian Gaborik and Dustin Brown and Alec Martinez. I mean, those are the only people that come close to him in that category.
Keep going. I don't know who Justin's agent is, but I think you're auditioning for the job. But keep going.
He has done all of this playing 16:26 per night. 16:26 per night. That's his time on ice. A guy like Drew Doughty literally has like 29 or 30 minutes to do what Justin Williams does in just 16. Think about that for a second.
Mike D. submits 86 Gilmore Federico with 18 points only because the Oilers were outed early. That's true. They're outed by the Calgary
Flames. About this for a second.
Steve Smith.
There is nobody in this league named Gnu Doughty. There's no confusion. But Justin Williams has had to play in the shadow of Jason Williams throughout his entire career.
True.
And finally
he's
emerging.
Yeah, I know. And unlike Jason Williams, was never caught by a torpedoing Rafi Torres curling around the Detroit Red Wings nets. He's never been caught that way. And he's the only player in these playoffs that was ever traded for Danny Markov. So there you go. Give it to him right there.
That's also I might have to make a campaign video between now and tomorrow extolling the virtues of Justin Williams' candidacy. By the way, Section 328 points out the Devils actually had the two top scorers in the playoffs that year, 1 point ahead of Gabrick. Gabrick had 17 points in 18 games. Langenbrunner with 18, Niedermeyer with 18. Niedermeyer was the guy that a lot of people said, why didn't he get the Conn Smythe that season? Because Marty wasn't as good as Jagr. Jagr had a .945 save percentage. That's pretty good.
Pretty good.
But yeah, that there was a situation where there were too many candidates on the Devil's side that could stay claim for it, and then everybody wanted to give it to Jagr.
I would have given it to three people that year. You can just give it to one. But it should have been the combination of Jean-Sébastien Jagr, Keith Carney, and Ruslan Soleil. Because those three players, specifically the two defensemen in front of J.S. Jagr, first of all, it was hard to get the puck at Jagr because Carney and Soleil were blocking everything. But then if it did miraculously get through those two guys, Jagr was there to make a ridiculous, awesome save.
Redunk.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Hey, you want to do story time?
All right.
I was thinking about this last night. But go ahead.
Before we get to story time, I think it's about that time of the show. It's 45 or 46 minutes into the podcast, in which we start the show proper, shall we?
Ooh, kick Maddie off guard.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
I think he wants to be Geppetto, not Pinocchio.
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I'm a little boy made of wood, Doc.
CD strings, Doc.
And so I'm inside of a whale's mouth.
Debate hockey. And more hockey.
Oh, yeah.
Versus Wyshynski.
I got no strings to hold me down, to make me fret or make me frown.
Chris Kraft writes in on the question of the day, coach's challenge. Perhaps Elaine Vigneault can challenge why Girardi is on the ice. GM320, the best news, they are expanding the trapezoid. Worst news, they still have the trapezoid.
Yeah. Yeah, I just get rid of
the whole
thing.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people saying that they really dig the whole thing that I wrote about on Puck Daddy today about the teams being hit financially for embellishment fines and diving fines. You like that idea? I love it.
I don't know. I know you love it. I go back and forth on it because I still, other than it's like jazz. I don't know it unless I hear it. I can't describe it to you. Everyone embellishes. I don't know where it stops being embellishment and starts being a dive. And I would even make the argument that the rules right now, as constructed, encourage players to do so. The rule book as it exists right now versus pre-2005 encourages players to do it. Back then, if you got hooked in the hip, you bent your knees and you skated harder. Now, if you feel a stick on your hip, you go down like a JFK. Are we better off with hooking or diving? That's the question you ask yourself as a hockey fan. Because we all hated what happened before 2005. Oh, it's terrible. Okay, diving's better? Because that's what you traded off. You've traded hooking for diving.
So, I like the idea.
I know you like it.
Change starts at home, sir. And I like the idea of the coaches being culpable for all these things and having to force their players to play a more respectful style of hockey and also force general managers and teams to not keep paying Pat Coletta money. That would also be a good thing, too.
See the worst? I don't know.
Nah, he's just a poster boy these days, you know what I mean? And again, like I said earlier, it's frustrating that the goalie interference stuff didn't get any traction. I mean, the idea that we're going to run away from reviewing it because it's a subjective call that isn't black and white, and yet we're going to have an entire supplemental discipline department that does the same thing. albeit in a longer duration of debate, is nonsensical. It's not as if we can't review subjective calls in this league.
So who makes the call then? Is it someone from Toronto, or do the referees get another look at it, huddle together, and say, okay, what's our call here?
I kind of would like the referees to look at it, because I do believe if it's their call to begin with,
yep,
that maybe they should clean up their own mess if it's
bingo.
If it's wrong.
Bingo.
That's
it for me. But it can't just be that referee. I think it needs to be a huddle. I really do.
Sure. That's fine. That's fine. I have no problem with that. What I hope is the case, and it's something that Coley Campbell talked about yesterday, was the idea that I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought. The idea that they're going to educate the players, the referees rather, during the summer, as to try to get all in the same standard. Because that's the other thing too. It's like
they do that every year. They do.
This is the full on assault education, like stop hitting guys in the head kind of level education is what they're talking about. And like that's good, because you know what? If you want me to back off on Tim Peel, then maybe if Timmy understood the rules better, we wouldn't have all these problems.
Well, considering that in the blog you wrote about him, there were some significant mistakes, I'd say you need to learn the rule book more than Tim Peel does.
You are. I'm not a referee. All right, ladies and gentlemen, story time. Story time with Jeff Merrick begins
how
now.
How come it's – okay, well, I'm going to get on the Tim Peel stuff another time. But the interesting thing, you know, last night as I'm watching the game in MSG, and I'm thinking, you know, right now all you need to do is put, you know, hockey tonight on the marquee and you'll fill the building. But it wasn't always that way in New York. We think of New York as being, you know, a very strong hockey market. It's a great sports market to begin with. But there were some really sort of cheap stunts that both the Rangers and the New York Americans, okay, both did to try to lure fans into the building. Both are guilty of it. I don't know if you've ever heard the story of, we'll start with the Rangers because they're the obvious one because they're playing in the Stanley Cup Final right now. But when the Rangers started, part of the marketing drive, I'm not sure if you know this story, which part of the marketing drive was to try to lure more ethnic people, namely Jews and Italians, into the rink to come and see hockey games because they weren't selling out. Now, there's a huge Jewish population in New York, as we know, and a big Italian population, as we know. So this is so bad. Now, the goaltender refused to do it, but they had asked Lauren Chabot, who I still believe, I think I make the case every year, who should be in the Hockey Hall of Fame, netminder Lauren Chabot, to change his name. And sometimes they would actually put this in the program in order to lure more Jewish people to the game, thinking he was one of theirs, change his name from Lauren Chabot to Lauren Chabotsky. Could you imagine trying that now? There was another guy who was used to try to draw more Italians to the game. Ended up playing with the Rangers for like 15 years. It's a guy from BC, Oli Renica. Okay? His name was changed, and you can actually probably hockey DB it and find the year, because I think it was 26, 27. They changed his name to Oli Rocco to try to draw more of an Italian crowd. Come see your boy representing the Italian community to come see the New York. He actually went through with it for an entire year. But here's the worst one, and this actually has a Pittsburgh Penguins association to it as well. The New York Americans, who are essentially the remnants of the old Hamilton Tigers, a team that was disbanded by the NHL after the players went on strike. The only way the players, by the way, were allowed back into the NHL is after they apologize to the NHL for going on strike. Okay? So these guys apologize for going back on strike, and some of the guys go back and they end up playing with the New York Americans. There was a guy by the name of René Beaulieu. You may know his son, Mark, who played in the NHL a bunch of years and was also the head coach of the Pittsburgh Penguins for 4 years in the 70s. That's Mark Beaulieu. This is so bad. In the first year of operation for the New York Americans, to try to draw – oh, this is awful – to try to draw fans to Madison Square Garden to see the Amerks play, they change his name. He's René Beaulieu from Montreal.
Okay.
They changed his name and tried to portray him as the first native Canadian hockey player in the history of the NHL. It was really Paul Jacobs years before in Toronto. But they tried to portray him in the marketing as the first native Canadian hockey player in the NHL. They changed René Beaulieu's name to, you ready for this?
Uh-huh.
Rainy Drinkwater.
No.
Yes, sir.
Wait a second.
Yes, yes,
rainy,
yes. This is the NHL.
Rainy.
Drink water.
Drink water.
Drink water. Yes. To try to market that this wonderful native Canadian hockey player is playing hockey for your New York Americans. That's how bad it was to try to get people to come in and watch hockey games. Drink water.
Rainy drink water. Wow.
Yeah.
That is impressive. Story time with Jeff Merrick. Yeah. That's a very impressive addition, sir.
A this
racially
is a little,
insensitive addition and culturally insensitive.
Completely racially insensitive addition, but these are the things that various NHL teams did to try to get people into the buildings to appeal to the ethnicity of people around the rink, namely Jewish folks and Italian folks for the Rangers, and then trying to portray Rene Beaulieu as Rainy Drinkwater, the NHL's first native hockey player.
Native hockey player.
All these things are there, folks. Yeah, all these things are there.
Did they have him skate out? Did they have him skate out in a headdress or no? Was that
in a headdress? No. I don't believe they did. But that family's legacy did live on in the NHL post 1967 expansion with the son Mark, who coached the Pittsburgh Penguinos. I don't know if he's ever asked about his father.
Random Penguin.
If he was referred to Rainey or Rene. Yeah, I know. Random Penguin. Mark Beaulieu, whose
Penguin.
Father was Rene / Rainey. Take your pick. Manny, drink water.
A couple of things news-wise. Kelly Buchberger gets bumped upstairs to a player personnel role, and Craig Ramsey, now an assistant associate, whatever you want to call him, coach with the Edmonton Oilers.
Yeah, it's funny because I had heard Ramsey's name attached to the Maple Leafs. I think it was pretty much a given that he was going to get a job somewhere this season. And I know that... Kelly Buchberger is still loved in Edmonton and specifically loved by Craig McTavish and Kevin Lowe. So if they're going to take him off the bench, not exactly a surprise they bumped him up to a player personnel position. But Ramsey will help that team. Craig Ramsey equals structure. Ramsey helps that squad. I'm surprised he's been out of the game as long as he has.
Exactly. You have a bunch of kids on this team that look at Dallas Eakin and say, here's a guy who we kind of like, but he's kind of, you know, he's young and he's bold and he's impulsive and he makes us eat celery. Grandpa's going to give us money out of his pocket. Grandpa's kind. Grandpa will take us to the toy store. Grandpa tells funny stories about crazy relatives. I mean, dad's like stern and stuff, and like sometimes he can be a real jerk, but Grandpa's great. Grandpa's wears sweaters. We like Grandpa.
That's a good one for the Oilers. They still have deep problems, but it's a good one for the Oilers.
You think so? Yep. Grandpa play defense.
Are they going to get a chance to draft a defenseman this year? Boosh. They're trying. They're trying to get that number one pick from Florida.
So I don't know if you saw. I talked to Sam Bennett about pull-ups yesterday.
And, what did he say?
He can do them. He can do them now. He can do two.
Okay.
And I said to him, why the hell did you put it on Vine? Why don't you put it on a Vine or an Instagram to show people that you could do pull-ups? You know, you could probably make that a pay-per-view for some people. But he said,
you know what he should do. You know what he should do.
What's that?
You know what he should do when he scores his first NHL goal? Two pull-ups on the crossbar.
He should.
Yep.
He should indeed. He said Jason Spezza called him to give him like support out of the blue. They go to the same gym, and he said Spezza called him to say, you know, sorry for what you're going through. Everything's going to be all right, kid. So that was really cool. I don't know if Spezza said chin up. That would be pretty awesome if he did.
Hey, buddy, chin up. Oh, God. Oh, that's funny. I'll tell you, man. Honestly, in a lot of ways, that actually helped his draft stock because he's gotten this far without being able to do a pull-up. That's pretty good. As you say to yourself as a team, here's the room for improvement.
I talked to Ekblad.
Mm-hmm.
Ekblad's one of these kids that A, looks like
he's
a
25.
Movie star.
He's 25 years old.
He might be 25. Yeah. And
holy
I was going to say,
smokes.
you could always tell the top picks from the lower picks because the top picks all talk like Ekblad or Tavares, like guys that seem like they're 25. That have been through this, that have media training. It's insane how, like,
that's
at
funny.
One point go ahead.
It's funny you mentioned those two because those two were granted exceptional status into the OHL, so the extra year of junior.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So he's with the OR group, and I'm sure that probably means something, like he's been schooled a little bit. But, like, It's insane how mature this kid is. And I you get the feeling that he would be a real difference maker wherever he's going to go. He's just big body defenseman, working on his shot for the last year to be a better power play point man. Dude's going to be a real solid player. So I don't begrudge any team trying to go out and get that top pick, and I wonder what Florida is going to ask for. And finally, on the Florida front, Harvey Filikoff, who's a reporter for the Sun Sentinel, reports that Dan Bylsma is talking with Dale Tallon on Monday. Yep. He talked to Tallon on Monday. We'll talk again in New York City this week with the owners and CEO of the Panthers about that opening. The order of likely Panthers coach, according to Harvey: Bylsma, Ron Wilson, Peters, Rennie, Crawford, Gallant. So Gallant is last, despite the connection to Huberto.
Hmm.
I think Bylsma gets that job.
So where's if he wants it, I think it's Bylsma's job. Yeah, for sure. Oh, absolutely.
But does he want it, though, is the question.
100%. That's sure. I mean, what else is out there right now for Dan Bylsma, other than Vancouver? But they're married to Willie Desjardins.
I agree with what you said the other day, which is that it might behoove him to collect some money, sit on the sideline for a little bit, wait for your turn.
Go work in hockey media for a year. Just get your paycheck, double dip. That's fine. Oh, by the way, Julian, surprised that as a Canadian, you butchered the pronunciation of Boileau. I was calling him Beaulieu because I was thinking of Nathan Beaulieu for some reason. Yeah, Boileau is the name, and it kind of... Bois de l'eau literally means drink water. So René Rainey Boileau, drink water, that became his name.
Well, sorry, you're going to have to be deported. You mispronounced a Canadian name, and now I'm afraid you can no longer have citizenship.
I know, sorry about that. But I did get that Paul Jacobs was the first native player in the history of the NHL. So there, take that.
Indeed. Jeff Pepper's Ramsey should bring in Garth Snow when he gets the axe to bring the Game of Thrones legitimacy. Oh, is it Ramsey Snow? Yeah, gotcha. What was the other one? Speaking of cheap stunts to get locals, can we talk about the last few years of the Atlanta Thrashers? Talking about your
you talked about that a lot. You talked a lot.
Oh,
about
I couldn't
that.
Get yeah, enough of that. I thought that was so shameless, and because it was shameless because they denied it. They denied that they were amassing all of the African-American players in the National Hockey League onto one team to pitch to the locals that didn't come to watch hockey games. You're like, no, it's a complete coincidence.
Just, we traded coincidence.
Chris Stewart.
Coincidence. Yeah. Yep.
Indeed. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's the show for today. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet back on the desk this evening for Hockey Central. Shanahan and Stelic again on the off night. Or the eve before it's all over for the New York Rangers. Do you see them coming back in any way, shape, or form, Wish?
Of course, because history will repeat itself. The Kings won two games in overtime against the Devils, had a shutout in Game 3, and then it was a series again before you knew it. So I expect this thing will go 6.
Going back to Los Angeles, are you?
No, I hope it's a sweep. It's Donuts with Dad Day at my daughter's school on Friday. Come on, Kings. Let's go, Kings. Go, Kings, go.
Oh, is it? We had orientation day for TJ at his new kindergarten today. That was fun. He just wanted to look at the totem pole out front of the school. Yep.
That's awesome. That's cute. Mm-hmm. By the way, one bit of news for the geeks out there. This just breaking now on Entertainment Weekly's website, and it's major news.
So,
as you may or may not know, there is a Daredevil television series that is going to be on Netflix, 13 episodes of Daredevil. The Man Without Fear, and playing Kingpin on that program, the big bad, the man who makes it all happen, Kingpin, Wilson Fisk himself, will not be played by an African-American like he was in the movie with Ben Affleck, but in fact be played by Vincent effing D'Onofrio as Kingpin in a Daredevil series. Oh, man, that is the best news ever.
Yeah, but René Boileau. But what about Lauren Shabotsky?
Once again, the Shabotsky. That's right, and Shabotsky was the name of Robin's character on How I Met Your Mother, and I believe that was a reference to that. See, now we're building pop culture bridges on this show.
Rainy Drinkwater?
Rainy Borg.
Wallow Drinkwater?
Gerald McCraney, who played Major Dad. See, all sorts of bridges being built pop culturally right now between us.
Rainy Rocco?
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow with a full preview of the final game of the season. And thanks to Glenn Healy for joining us. I know Glenn Healy is a big hit with the fans of this show and fans in general. And I hope that you all enjoyed the
I thought Healy was great. I thought he was great on the podcast. I used to have him on Hockey Night Radio all the time, and he was golden. Never a doubt in my mind. There's a bias. I know a lot of people don't like him. Is it okay? Let me ask you this: which is the most thankless position in an NHL broadcast situation? Which is the one position that everyone is out to just slaughter? Is it the play-by-play guy? Is it the analyst? Is it the between the benches guy? Is it the ringside reporter? What is it?
It's the color analyst usually.
So it's anyone that has an opinion. That's the consistency. Whether it's columnists, whether it's someone involved in a game broadcast, anyone with an opinion is the guy that gets destroyed.
That's right.
Always.
Unless their opinion's always right.
Unless their opinion jibes with yours, then they're idiots and don't know a thing.
Oh, man.
Right? You get it. Like, if someone vehemently disagrees with you, do they bring up points, or is it just wish you're an idiot?
Because it's usually wish you're an idiot.
Because your points don't jibe with them.
It's shorthand for I don't agree with your points.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but listen, compared to Glenn Healy, like, if you compared, like, my Yahoo comment section to what Glenn Healy gets on Twitter every night, my Yahoo comment section would be, like, 100 Valentines, 100 tiny Valentines with bears shooting arrows into hearts compared to what Glenn Healy gets on Twitter every night.
I know, everybody gets it.
Who do you think's more hated, Healy or Maguire?
Oh, Pierre.
You think Pierre's more hated?
Pierre gets crushed everywhere. You know, Twitter is just relentless. And I've made this point from day one. I think the guy would be awesome. If that guy had a podcast, I would listen every single day. Because at the heart of that, I know you don't like the delivery, not a lot of people do. The junior hockey references dropped in awkward places, but the guy knows a ton. He really does. It's almost if you're just dying for like a really good producer to say, hey, let's focus all of this into an awesome podcast. But it'd be a great one. But it'd be fantastic. Because that's one thing you can't deny. One thing you can never deny about Pierre Maguire. He does know a ton. He knows a lot, man. He knows a ton.
He knows a poop ton.
Hmm.
For sure. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you on the morrow. Bye.
Yes, the Wednesday morrow.